Welcome to the Bylines Network podcast, an audio accompaniment to our growing family of regional Bylines publications.
This week we're going to be talking about the delay to the final easing of coronavirus restrictions, the Chesham and Amersham by-election, as well as our choice for Undercovered Story of the Week.
And this week we'll be interviewing Liz Webster once again to discuss the implications of the new trade deal with Australia the government have whipped up. I'm Julian Greenbank in West England.
And this is Chris in Brighton.
And we'll be your hosts for this week. So, needless to say, it's been a week.
It has been a week.
A lot has happened. The Euro started. That was nice.
And we also found out that we can't go out in club until July the 19th. Which, I mean... Can't say I'm surprised. Many of us are surprised.
No, I wasn't. Honestly, the only people who I don't think weren't surprised were the people who weren't looking at the numbers. We have now gotten to a point where we are at the same number of cases as we did with the first April lockdown last year. So yeah, it's hardly a surprise that we got delayed to the 19th now, isn't it?
Yeah, the 19th, which is, you know, 3 days after my birthday, but no problem. I was planning hopefully to plan a night out, but no, I can still wait until after, hopefully. I mean, but on a serious note, you know, considering that the Delta variant, that has made up, I think, 99% of the cases, and the fact it's more infectious, it is the right decision.
Oh, yeah,
we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the you know, delayed decisions made by Boris and the mistakes he made in terms of quarantine and putting countries on the red list.
It was around like the 23rd of April, more or less, like that trip to India and allowing all kinds of flights to come in from India. So yeah, anyone who knew about that kind of predicted this. Like everyone from like the higher ups at Bylines itself to even like a few scant people that I know, particularly my American friends who I told about this, they literally just went, that's going to come bite you in the behind. And I just went, I know, but I can't exactly do much about it.
And it did, didn't it? I mean, it obviously has. and it's interesting. I mean, looking at, Matt Hancock was giving evidence to the committee, I think it was this week or last week. And he was talking about how, border closures could have stopped the spread of variants. And it's like,
oh, you duh. Think?
Duh. It's like, is that a sudden realization you've made now?
Yeah, that is big Dominic Raab realizing how important the Calais crossing is to the UK economy. Energy.
No, exactly. It just makes you want to put your head in a pillow and scream. Like, it's just so obviously frustrating. And I'm not a scientist by any means. But I mean, we are in a completely different situation now. I mean, we have vaccines. They're showing to work.
That does seem to be like the main reason why we're not going into another massive lockdown. Because as I said, the number of cases is about more or less what it was in the April lockdown. But the important number to look at is the number of hospitalizations. Because last time I looked, it was like 1,250 hospital admissions. This is from yesterday, though. And the number of cases was just over 11,000. So that means 1 in 11 people are going to the hospital, which was fewer than the first April lockdown. So it does seem like the scientists who say the vaccine stops serious infections if you catch it. So that is encouraging to see that the vaccine actually works.
And it's also fantastic stuff that, you know, everyone over 18 as of yesterday can now book their jabs. And I mean, if we get an extra month to get those people vaccinated, and, you know, there's been numerous news reports about the delayed lifting of restrictions, that by delaying the lifting of restrictions set to halve the UK's COVID hospital admissions. I mean, if anything, that's worth it. We don't want to risk another overload of hospitals, and I think it's the right decision. Obviously, you've got the regulatory MP stood up calling foul and saying it's unfair. And
oh yes, is this the so-called COVID research group?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think despite our joking despite our frustrations, we do agree with this decision. We do believe it is the right decision to do.
But it could have been avoided.
It absolutely could have been avoided. But, you know, if there is one thing I can sum up the government's response to COVID-19, it is doing the right thing eventually, and the consequences could have been avoided, you know?
Mm-hmm. Action too late.
Yeah.
Decisions made too late. And you know, we can all say, and it's pretty evident that a lot of the delay to putting India on the red list was around the potential trip to India that the Prime Minister was going to make to secure a trade deal. I mean, let's be honest, there was a lot of noise about that, and that just sort of went away. And now look at it, look where we are. This totally could have been avoided.
And to avoid the naysayers who say, oh, it's easy to say that in hindsight, Keir Starmer was saying this in February. We need to secure the borders better. We need to like make sure they're quarantined and all that kind of thing. And would you look at where we are now? Him being right. So the other big news since our last episode was there was another by-election going on. We seem to be having quite a few of them.
And we've still got more to go.
Oh, we've still got more to go. More politics,
then, don't we?
Yeah, we love more politics. Keeps us busy, keeps us employed.
So, let's be honest. It was quite a shock result to quite a few people. To no one more than the Tory party, I think.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think it was quite a shock for the people who won, to be honest. Yeah, we are, of course, talking about the Chesham and Abersham by-election, and I do apologise if I've mispronounced that, which was historically a Tory seat. It's been like that since the 1990s when they last changed the boundaries, and it was a Tory seat before that for a long time. I'm not going to put a number on it because I can't remember.
I think it has been since the seat was put together.
Yeah,
someone may correct me, but I think that's right. I think it always has been conservative.
So yeah, it is part of what the media refer to as the blue wall.
Be honest, Labour did not have a chance in that they just didn't have a chance.
No, not really.
And I mean, it's interesting talking about the people who typically did vote Labour swinging to the Lib Dems to help them push over the line, but I think a big reason why the Lib Dems won is partly that, obviously partly Labour voters and others swinging to the Lib Dems, but also just the fact that most Tory voters didn't show up. That's a huge thing, which not many people are talking about. You know, 17,000 Tory voters who voted in 2019 did not turn up to the ballot box. If, you know, the majority, I think, was 7,000, 8,000?
8,000.
It's 8,000. So 17,000 Tory voters stayed at home. If they turned up, it would have been a completely different story. And, you know, that begs the question, why not? Why didn't they show up? Is it sort of them feeling disillusioned? They just can't bring themselves to vote for Labour or the Lib Dems? Is this just a typical midterm protest vote or the sign of a larger trend? What do you think?
I think it's a mixture of all of the above. But I do also... There's this YouTuber called Jay Foreman who did an excellent series called Politics Unboring, where he discussed like the history of the Houses of Parliament, the history of the noises that they make, the history of the noise that they make, the history of our electoral system. And he also did a video about why people don't vote. And one of the main reasons why people don't vote, like the first one he literally said was, who I want to win is going to win anyway. And, you know, that can lead to like a lot of people just going, I mean, who I want to win is going to win anyway, so why bother? Which, of course, can lead to such results such as one time in 1910 where a guy literally got elected by the space of a vote. I think it's definitely a mixture of the left-leaning voters voting for the Liberal Democrats and, you know, conservative voters not turning up because they're either disillusioned with the party or they voted left, or they're disillusioned with the party but they don't want to vote left, or indeed just being like, well, we're a safe Tory seat, so why bother? Yeah,
I mean, it's interesting because like when you look at the local elections, there was a similar trend. You know, you could see support for the Conservatives, I wouldn't say crumbling, maybe that's too strong of a word, but
going down.
Certainly falling or wobbling, you know. You know, you had places like Witney and Chipping Norton gaming Labour councillors. You know, Sussex, you know, some quite long-term Tory councillors in Sussex lost their seats. A lot that was blamed, I think, on sort of the Conservatives' the housing policy, so potentially building on Greenbelt, and that's obviously quite unpopular amongst quite a lot of Conservative voters.
Well, that's the reasoning the Tories seem to be doing for why they lost this by-election. They say it's because of their housing policy and the fact that HS2 is going through Chesham and Abersham's neck of the woods.
That stand up?
Hmm?
Because the Lib Dems supported HS2 in the House of Parliament, didn't they?
They did, indeed. And yet many people felt fine voting for the Liberal Democrats this time. There are a number of people who we know who say this is something to do with the fact that, you know, a number of voters who are tired with the way the party's going, you know, with them reshaping the British identity into a Brexit-leaning one, and, you know, the lies and the corruption. And that could certainly be part of it. However, if there's one thing we've seen over the last couple of years, I think it's that the Conservative voters can put up with a lot before they draw the line.
Yeah, I know. And I mean, it makes you wonder what was the straw that broke the camel's back. I mean, and is that something that's going to continue? Because if it is, it should make other by-elections quite interesting. And I mean, we'll see what happens in Batley and Spen in next month, because, you know, that's projected to go Conservative, unfortunately. And it makes you think, are we seeing a sort of realigning of the parties? And, you know, the Tories taking the north and more progressive parties taking seats in the south.
That is something we covered in a previous episode. Yeah, I believe it was episode 4, where we broke down the local elections.
If you've not already listened to that fantastic episode, go and give it a listen.
Oh, why, thank you. I wasn't going to say anything because I star in that episode. where we do see this trend where it's like the south is turning towards left-leaning parties and the north is turning towards conservatives. But what does this result mean for the by-election? Quite frankly, I think it's too early to tell. Like, we obviously, for the left, it does show like a progressive alliance amongst the voters at least is possible, because let's face it, quite a lot of Labour and Green didn't vote for Labour and Green this time. And, you know, if the stats are anything to go by, they voted Liberal Democrat. But what at the end of the day, to me at least, I think Mitch Benn put it the best, it might not mean a lot. It just means one less brick in the blue wall.
It is, and it'll be interesting to see how this plays out in terms of a general election or even national polling. You know, will you see more seats in the south go orange or red or green, or just lose a bit of their blue even?
Mm.
One less Tory MP is a good thing.
One less Tory MP.
But then we may well see a gain in Batley and Spen, so we'll be able to back up one again. So we'll see.
Right, well, hello again to Liz Webster, frequent guest of the Bylines Networks podcast. How are you doing?
Hello, Jules. Great to see you.
Great.
I'm very good.
Yeah, we've got you on so often, I think we should get you as a regular host.
I'd be very happy to do a weekly podcast with you.
Ah, fabulous to hear. So you're here today to talk about farming, specifically your Save British Farming campaign. So first off, I think it's best to ask, what is this farming trade deal that Boris is trying to negotiate with the Aussies?
Yeah, so the free trade deal with Australia has taken 3 months to negotiate. And people should bear in mind, normally these free trade deals take about 7 or 8 years to negotiate. So that should throw up some flags. It's shocking that we are now being rollercoastered into a deal with Australia. We're leaving and damaging even further the market on our doorstep with half a billion people, which we've got all of our network set up in, to do a trade deal with Australia, which is population of what, about 20 million on the other side of the world. And they have got not that many people, but they've got a lot of area, and they've also got a lot of livestock and fields to grow things. So that means that they've got, and better weather than us, so it means that they've got what we call surplus agri goods. Added to that, they use methods which are illegal here. And the, you know, the list is extensive. They use hormones in their cattle, antibiotics. The cattle are reared in feedlots, which means they don't go into a field, they're just in a pen of mud. And because they're in these pens, they need regular antibiotics because they catch infections easily. And then they also use pesticides and herbicides that are banned here. So the feed that they're feeding these cattle is, you know, grown with chemicals that are illegal here. So the whole thing is awful, that we're allowing this low standard food to come in, and it then intoxifies our country. Which means that then, you know, the European Union are like, oh, we don't want to have your bad stuff coming into us. So it means that we lose our, and it's already battered by this, the inadequate trade deal that we've got with the EU since Brexit, and it's only going to be hampered further. So what this means for British farming is that for those people who are wealthy, they will pay more for premium goods. So farmers who farm to the highest standards and have perhaps a farm shop, organic farm, are going to be investing more into producing food because they're going to have a captive market. That person is going to be shopping there all of the time to avoid eating any of the bad food. The middle and lower income people are then in the supermarkets going to be eating this food. And it you can't avoid it because it will come in on ships, that live animals will come in on ships. It will be processed here and then it'll be packaged as British. And if this goes on to do the American trade deal, which I think is the plan, the Americans will insist on no origin food labeling anyway, which is exactly what happened in Mexico when they signed NAFTA. So that at the moment is where we're headed, and we're being steamrolled into it, despite the fact that the Conservatives promised to uphold our high standards. And what they're doing is tying our British farmers' hands behind their backs by saying, you have to farm to these standards. We're going to stop you live exporting as well. We've closed off your export market. And then all of this lower standard food is going to flood in. And it means, in essence, they're shrinking our food production capabilities. So a lot of farms will go out of business or will go into, you know, a holiday park or any, you know, golf course, or will be doing something else rather than producing food. And for a country, an island nation with a large population, it's scary because it means we're falling into a weakened place where we rely on other countries on the other side of the world to feed us. And that's not good.
So yeah, you mentioned earlier that it's going to be like shipped over on like ships, and I can't imagine that's going to be like very good for the environment either, which is also another thing Boris seems to have gone back on, because he promised to be like a green prime minister or something to that effect. So is there any way to stop it?
I don't know if there's, I mean, there could be an argument with the Paris Climate Agreement, that if you're shipping your food from halfway across the world, you're not adhering to that agreement. So there could be an argument about that. But as you know, it's very protracted for that to take place. And they've all the time been very sneaky by promising one thing and then delivering another. And once this trade deal is signed, it's pretty impossible to change. You know, once you agree a big international free trade deal, it's not easy to torpedo. The only way you're going to torpedo it is really by going back into another membership with the European Union. You know, it needs to be a major event like that. So, it looks like it's going to be agreed and signed over this G7 meeting on the 11th of June. So when you think about the issue of the European Super League, and this is something I find this fascinating, in that everyone got so riled up about this football Super League. And, you know, we had all sorts of celebrities and footballers saying, no, you're not taking my football away from us, you know, and all that kind of thing. And yet here we are with our food, which means that, you know, people could starve without food. People can die without food. Our food is being taken from literally under our feet. And where is the resistance to it? Where are the big names, Marcus Rashford or Jamie Oliver or any of these people? Where is the resistance to this happening? So I think if we can bring a wave of protest and disenchantment about what's in front of us, of course it can be changed before it's signed, and that's what I'd like to see. But people are so, at the moment, so happy about being able to go out to the pub for the first time in months, that I think people are largely distracted.
What other knock-on effects could there be for the British consumers? Like, you mentioned earlier that in Australia they like hormone pack their cows and like keep them in pens and what. So what would be like the health disadvantages to eating meat that like this?
Well, I mean, we've got a whole report on our website, savebritishfarming.org, about the impact on public health. It's enormous. You're looking at, you know, massive resurgence of salmonella, which we haven't really had for many years because our standards have been driven up all of the time. You're looking at antibiotic resistance in years, which means you could die of an infected ingrown toenail. It's that simple. And cancer, you know, the carcinogens in these products are serious. So for human health, the impact is enormous and frightening. And for the environment, to think that, you know, the Australian shipping market for live exports is horrific. They have huge super tankers where they ship 6,000 or 7,000 animals, cows, and they've had disasters with that. So, you know, several of them have been involved in storms and then sunk, and a whole crew and all those animals died. So environmentally, it's an absolute horror show, and it just shows the rank hypocrisy of Boris Johnson and this Conservative government, in that they've promised to be green. As I remember David Cameron coming out with their Huskies, and it was all a facade, because what they're delivering is the absolute opposite of what people want.
So if you want to help stop all that, then I would suggest signing up to savebritishfarming.org, which is run by our very own Liz Webster. What do you have to do to sign up there, Liz?
Yeah, go to the website and there's a sign up details. There's also an automated letter system to send to your MPs. Please do that and share it widely and get people to do the same. We do know that MPs do respond to these letters, and the more they have, the more it works. So do what you can and support any events that come up. I'm beginning to think that there will be a general election, possibly even next year. So in this time, if there's an election and we change power in the next year or two, there is hope of bringing change, because agriculture is a slow burn industry. You know, it's not like the fishing industry that closes overnight. So there is hope of change. It's not going to it's not going to be closed down completely with signing of this deal. But to bring change, we need to bring power, which means we need a progressive alliance to unite against the Conservatives and get our country back.
Liz Webster, thank you very much for joining us again.
Thanks very much. Good to see you.
Okay, now we come to Undercovered Story of the Week. We really need to come up with a jingle for this, I think. The idea is that the hosts select one story each about a story that really should be getting a lot more conversation, but no one seems to be doing it, at least in our circles. So, one article I have picked is from The Guardian. That was originally on the front page of The Telegraph, I believe. Sit back, because I'm going to be talking about sport for a little bit.
Sports. Got to get my sport cap on.
So, it was reported a couple of days ago that UEFA are threatening the UK government with moving the Euros final away from Wembley, which is the national stadium for all those who don't know, and moving it to Budapest. Now you can try that again. Unless, and this is the important bit, 2,500 UEFA and FIFA officials are just allowed to enter our country without quarantining. Now, I don't think I need to explain why this is bad, considering the fact that we are living in the middle of the Delta variant, but...
I mean, you only have to look at Cornwall and the G7 that was held there a week or so ago, at the impact that massive events like this have on instances of cases where, you know, around St. Ives, I think you had a 250% increase in COVID cases. It makes utterly no sense.
And yeah, and really, this really just goes to show something darker going on with UEFA and with FIFA. Now, I'm not going to go on and on about how bad FIFA and UEFA are. If you want to get like the full story about why they're such vile corporations, John Oliver did like 3 long form video essays about the corruption at FIFA. But UEFA, which is the United European Football Association, they do like the Champions League and are essentially head of all the Premier Leagues across Europe. They are supposedly a non-profit organization with 1.3 billion in the bank, who basically act like judge, jury, and executioner for everything. Like when that whole ESL debacle thing was going on, it was literally a choice between, okay, do I pick the rich people or the rich people to side with? And, you know, they're really just showing like their true colors with this and with threatening players who get rid of sponsorships off the tables with fines, because it's like, which is like a whole other thing.
But I mean, it is a horrendous kind of, it is a story which, I mean, again, it links back to, I think, what the government really want. They want to showcase the UK and they want to show it as a place which can host these huge events. I think potentially part of their mindset behind this is also, you know, they want to show that the UK is dealing with COVID in a really good way. We're in a good place. They want to show that on televisions across Europe, across the world. But obviously people who live in this country know that's not quite the case at the moment.
So yeah, this is basically just like, this is basically showing UEFA and the UK government for like their true colours. Like they don't care about the rules. They're above that. Just let 2,500 people just into the country. I'm sure nothing bad can happen there.
the decision, it just, my head can't take it because it's just so stupid.
Welcome to UEFA.
Welcome to Conservative Britain.
And I'm genuinely surprised that no one's talking more about this, because it's like, you know, everyone was talking about it when, you know, talking about India and the possible Delta variant that was going to pop up because we were letting in visitors from India just willy-nilly. And it's like 2,500 people is not an insignificant amount of people, you know. And yeah, it might only be for a couple of days, but, you know, that could still be pretty damaging. Why is it's also interesting. I don't get why no one's talking about this.
But it is interesting because, you know, you talk about the this article, and I had a read it earlier, and you know, it's set to exempt 2,500 people from quarantine restrictions. Does that, I would hope that they're also engaging in testing, but we also have seen the farce that we had at the border during the early period of the pandemic, which, you know, there was no checking. I went away last summer to Denmark, and although, you know, travel was quite easy then, but you had to fill out a form to say where you were going to be, where you'd come from, what countries you'd been in the last 14 days. They were emphasizing how important that was that you fill it in on arrival because it's going to be checked. It wasn't. You strolled through passport control, you got out, you went home. I know people who went away, not very good friends of them, but I'm, you know, I know these people. They went to France over the summer, or towards the sort of autumn time when they were supposed to be quarantining on return. They didn't quarantine, neither in France or the UK. And there's no checks on that. And there hasn't been until very recently. Again, like we talked about it earlier, this is something I think we're going to be talking about in a month or so's time, because it was such a bad decision.
So yeah, that's my undercovered story of the week. Chris?
On to the story I've chosen is the fact that the government are seeking to strip the Electoral Commission of its powers to prosecute. Now, this is going to be in a new elections bill, which they're hoping to bring forward. Of course, this follows the controversy over who funded the refurbishment of the Downing Street flat, which, you know, it's very suspiciously timed if you're a cynic like myself. And, you know, it's pretty plain that the Conservatives have their knives out for the Electoral Commission. I think ever since, you know, Vote Leave were fined for overspending, and ever since, you know, we know the Conservatives have a fractious relationship with transparency and honesty. The Electoral Commission has sought to shine light on that. Taking the right to prosecute away, and their justification saying that it's a waste of public money, surely, you know, if there is an independent body who investigates impropriety in elections and in political parties, they should be having all the public money that they need to do that job, and not having their you know, their powers curtailed. You know, you had Conservative MPs saying it's a waste of public money. Labour, of course, aren't very happy. They're talking about it being a government attempt to, you know, skew democracy. And this hasn't been spoken about anywhere. I think I've read three articles so far about it on sort of a quick search. It was in The Independent and The Mirror and The Financial Times. This is a massive issue. It is the Conservatives actively saying, we're going to take this power away because potentially we're frightened of what you could do. Yeah, we're above the law. And no government's above the law. No prime minister is above the law. And it is all just suspiciously timed. And, you know, if anybody sees this as anything but a power grab, frankly, you're naive. You know?
Yeah, I did read that article when you sent it to me. And yeah, you're completely right. It is an important story that should be covered more. But I think one of the reasons why it's not covered more is because it's, you know, I think in terms of news, we certainly live in a world where it's like a subject is a hot topic for a week, and then we move on to the next one. Like, hey, remember when like a bunch of fascists stormed the Capitol? That was this year, and no one's talking about it. And I feel like I'm going.
It was January. It was January.
That was January. Oh. That was the 6th of January.
Oh, it's been a long year.
It's been a long year. And like,
but again, like, I think you're absolutely right.
But we've already had like the election controversy because I believe they're trying to introduce like voting ID into with this new bill. So yeah, it's just like, oh, the Tories are committing election fraud. Old news, mate.
Slash have been cozy with people who already have committed election fraud. And I mean, it's, you know, you sort of got onto a point which I think was really, it plays a part in how this story is being not covered that much. Obviously, we're living through COVID. This is a massive issue. It's an important issue which needs to be covered. But this is something that also is going to be potentially have huge ramifications in the future. If this bill goes through and the Electoral Commission loses its powers to prosecute, that then leaves the powers to do so in the hands of the Prosecution Service and the police. I don't see the Prosecution Service or the police getting involved in electoral spending.
Mostly because every time the police have done this in the past, they've either dropped it or they've just handed it off to somebody else. So there is precedent for that.
Yeah, and it's something that, you know, especially like mentioned before, this government has a habit of spinning the truth and just spouting absolute lies and just completely behaving in a way that you wouldn't expect the leader of a Western, you know, a full democracy to behave. And this has serious sort of implications for the holding to account of political parties, not just the Conservatives, but you know, political campaigns, other political parties. It's astounding, and people should be, you know, shouting about this in the rooftops, and people should be absolutely enraged by this.
Many thanks again to our guest for this week, Liz Webster. Follow her and Save British Farming on Twitter.
Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram at Bylines Pod for further updates.
The music is Voxel Revolution by Kevin MacLeod. Thanks, Kevin.